Okay. Good afternoon, everybody, and very welcome to this session called Developing Core Business Applications with Domain-Driven Design, or DDD. I'm Jimmy Nilsson from Factor 10 in Sweden, and I'm very happy to be here today. So thanks a lot to the organizer for inviting me to speak at TechEd this year. Here are a few words about me, and as you see here, my latest book was called Applying Domain-Driven Design and Patterns. It's a bit, or some parts of it are a bit dated nowadays, but I still and strongly believe that the cover of it is the most beautiful one of all the DDD books out there. The translators in China and Japan didn't agree, so they come up with their own bridge covers for some reason. More important is that I guess I have the same background as most of you in here. I'm a developer and an architect since the last 25 years. And I'm struggling hard every day to become better at that craft. So one of my core principles is to dare to challenge. That's very important to me. And if people haven't been challenging in the past, we probably wouldn't have cars. We would still believe the earth was flat, and we wouldn't even have sliced bread. So that's how we are taking huge leaps, and that goes for our everyday as well, I think. And talking about cars, this is what I call the T model, but in this case it means that it's not enough for us as developers to just be very deep regarding technical excellence. It's also important to be broad regarding the business perspective to understand the problems that we are dealing with, the domains we are working in. So we should do things in the right way, but we should also work with the right things. So we need both those perspectives. And both of those, I think, are close to or connected to domain-driven design, which is what this presentation will be mostly about, of course. But combining those, dare to challenge, the T model and domain-driven design, we are able to have what I call the exponential effect, making big leaps. I have a little observation here about humans in general, and it's definitely developers too. Some developers are acting like this to a project. The blue box here is the project, and the developer is totally filling it. It looks quite nice. The developer is doing every task that is needed in a decent way, probably. So at first sight, I like this, but on the other hand, maybe this isn't so good after all. At least it's not very much challenging the box. I'm not saying this is better either, just flooding the box and being everywhere and doing everything. And probably not this either, a very careful developer, not trying out as hard as he can or she can. This guy is totally missing the box. Once again, not so good. But sometimes we need to push the limits a little bit, challenge the requirements, for example, and going out of that box. Maybe the box size was wrong. Maybe we don't need to go out of it. It should just shrink or have a different shape. And as I said, I think some developers are like this. And the broader we are regarding understanding the business, the better. And the deeper we are regarding technical excellence, the better. But it's not enough to be just one of those. We need both dimensions to become really, really powerful and have a great career in development. So, why domain-driven design? Is it because it's the latest and trendiest there is? Actually, I don't think so. That book up in the corner, Domain-Driven Design, Tackling Complexity in the Heart of Software, which was written by Eric Evans and published 10 years ago. And 10 years in our business, that's like a lifetime, or maybe two lifetimes. That's a long time ago, so it's definitely not the latest. Actually, I heard the other day that domain-driven design is trendy, and I thought that was a little bit like a joke. But looking in this room, this is an amazing sight for me. I've been speaking about this for quite some time and practicing and trying it out. In the early days, I had like two people in the audience, both friends, listening. And now we are like, I guess, 500 at least. Wow, totally amazing. So no, this is not about being trendy, I think. There is something else to it. Are we having a new template in Visual Studio, and because of that we see a lot of interest in domain-driven design? No, we are not, and I don't think we will either. That's not the nature of this beast, or not the nature of domain-driven design. That won't work out. And I don't think it's the best practice either. Actually, best practice has an effect on me. Some alarm bell goes off when people talk about the best practice, and I get scared and run out of that room. Because best practice has a tendency of being the worst practice in certain situations. That's happening to me, at least, over and over again. So domain-driven design isn't that either. So what is it then? I think it's something much better than those three things here. And I try to summarize it in a naive sentence of my Swedish English, saying the following. I believe that domain-driven design can help very much in creating business value. I think that's what it's all about. And if we take a little step back, talking about what software development is all about, we come back to this question again at a little higher perspective, I guess. Why are we developers? Why do we exist? What's our purpose? I think it's about creating business value. But quite often, and quite many of us, have a tendency of being more focused on tech, and that's our main interest, maybe not money. And the good thing here is that if we work with what we believe are the most interesting stuff, and to me that is creating great code, we are actually having a very direct connection to the business value. If we have created great code and the business people come to us with a new opportunity and ask us, please could you do this and this and this and add that feature there, how long will it take? And we say, well, actually, our code is in control and that will just take a few days. And maybe that's a very strong situation to be in, and you make millions easily. On the other hand, it's not too uncommon that the arrow here is quite thin. The code base isn't giving or providing a lot of business value. Maybe you have seen code bases like that. Code bases nobody want to touch. It will take like 2 years to fix that little feature. Have you seen that? I'll tell you a secret here today. Actually, I've been responsible for creating lots of those code bases in the past. Not something I'm proud of course, but something to learn from and try to not achieve again. So, of course, we want to have that thick arrow between the value and the code. This little model I've found to work out super in certain discussions with business people, because all of a sudden they understand why we are whining to them when they don't allow us to put as much time into a certain problem and things like that. When they understand that we are whining because we are actually taking care of their business value, they start crying out of happiness and they love us. That's a really powerful thing to tell them. We are not whining just because we have a certain interest in their business value. That's really a good story for them to hear. Okay, why and what? And then the next question is, of course, how? How do we achieve great code? Any ideas? The good thing here is that you can say anything. It's probably right. Please? Architecture, someone said. Sorry? Patterns, thank you. I totally agree. More? DDD, someone said. That's a really good idea. I think that's something that fits perfectly in this picture. Test-driven development, the best people, and so on and so forth. The moral of the story here is that there isn't just one single silver bullet, of course not. We need a combination of several things for creating great code, I think. I've had a little problem in the last few years with Scrum being that silver bullet, and everything will just work out. As soon as we go to Scrum, everything will be fine. Actually, I think it might be the opposite quite often. So, no, that's not helping too much. It might a little bit. There are so many other things we need to do well as well. I have this little model that I call basic software economics. And when complexity increases, something else will decrease. What is the first thought you get here? Quality, I totally agree. More? Maintainability. I have to change this. I wrote productivity, and maintainability would be nice too, yeah. So, all you said was right, but let's go for productivity for now. And again, a very intuitive model. Of course, if something is complex, we will be slower working with that. Nothing new there. We know this from every area, and it's very true for software development too. What's more interesting here is that not all complexity is of the same style or type. So the question is, do we have essential complexity because the domain is complex, or have we added accidental complexity? Typical examples of accidental complexity might be that we find a new cool and large framework that we just want to try out, and we add that to the project, and then we have to drag that around, and it will probably hurt us. Another typical example, in the past I was great at guesswork. I was listening to the client and he wanted feature one, and I thought, well, tomorrow he's going to ask for 2, 3, 4, 5 and so on as well. So I actually created or developed 10 different things. A year later the client comes and asks me, could you please add this number 2 now? And I tell him, well, actually, I'm already done, and I feel like a hero. That's really cool, and he's happy and everything. Unfortunately, I added 8 more things. He never wanted them. I'm carrying them in all my work, and he has paid for them. That's just accidental complexity. I added stuff just in case. I did a guess there. I've stopped doing that now, trying to at least. Maybe you are thinking about other examples of accidental complexity. But the important thing here is that if we are able to decrease the accidental complexity, the productivity will increase at the same time. So that's something to fight every day. I said that if we have a code base that is in control and in great shape, we are able to create lots of business value, but it's not just about that. I also think actually that the size is of tremendous importance. Because the size drives cost. If you have a larger code base, it automatically will cost more to maintain that piece. It drives bugs. If you have 0 lines of code, how many bugs will you probably have? And if you have more code, you will have more bugs. That's totally intuitive. It drives delays as well. We are slower working in that huge amount of code. What happens when management sees those things, that we are delayed? What's the automatic reaction from management? We are delayed in the project, we say, and they say, maybe. And when that won't work, work harder didn't help. I'm fired. Maybe. I think you are a little bit too tough. I'm glad you are just developers and not management. Yeah. No. More people, of course, that's the automatic. It's just, they can do it in the sleep. Add more people, of course. Unfortunately, more people will add more code. And we are in a very evil or negative circle here, going downwards. So, this is something I strongly believe and something I'm fighting every day. We are looking for being able to have a tiny little code base and solving the problem instead of just letting it spread out everywhere. And that will make us so much more efficient, absolutely. So, what was domain-driven design about? It's about creating business value. So what is it then? In the past, I actually got that question several times. Each and every time, I was a little bit surprised. Like, well, don't you know that? Domain-driven design, it's about love, I said, or harmony or balance. And the guy who asked me always became a bit irritated, or quite irritated. So I was very happy when Eric Evans, who wrote the book later on, wrote this little text, because I think it describes domain-driven design very well. So, domain-driven design is an approach to the development of complex software. First little keyword here, complex. Probably this tool won't help you in every situation. And I think that's just a way of becoming more trustworthy. If I told you that this will help you all the time, of course you wouldn't believe in that. So yesterday, Caesar at Microsoft had a great presentation about domain-driven design, saying something like this, that of course different situations need different approaches. We all know that. But domain-driven design is especially for dealing with complex situations. And we are doing three things when we are working in a domain-driven fashion. First off, we are focusing on the core domain. Because in most enterprises, there are so much different problems, so many different areas that we can build or develop software for. But we will never be able to do it everywhere. We should instead, of course, focus our efforts where the money is, where the value is, where the enterprise have their competitive edge. So, if someone asks me what I'd like to work on for a problem in a company, I say, as long as it's the most important part, I don't care, actually. Any domain, as long as it's important. Second thing, we are exploring models in creative collaboration between domain experts and software developers. So we will come back to the model word here in a few words, few minutes. But this is very important part here that we are not just listening to or getting a spec and doing our best. We are actually trying really, really hard to work with the people who knows most about the domain. I told you before that I think it's very important for us as developers to care about the domain. But of course we won't be as good about it as those who have been working in that domain for 20, 30, 40 years. So that's key for our success in those projects, to really be able to collaborate well. And third, we are speaking a ubiquitous language within an explicitly bounded context. And this means that we are trying to come up with a shared language that everybody in the project knows and talks all the time. It's a very efficient way of not understanding each other. If I started speaking Swedish here, I guess maybe only one would understand what I said. Two, okay. Oh, loads of Swedes in here. Yeah, cool. But if we come up with a shared language, of course we understand each other better. And the language is also a very efficient design tool. We're very good at talking the language, and it helps us developing the software a lot. And the second thing in that sentence is very important. We are not able to come up with that shared language for everything, for the whole enterprise, for example. We have to pick a certain subset, a certain part, and within that bounded context, we are extremely careful with the language, but we don't care about if someone else in the company used the same word for something else. It doesn't matter. So maybe some of you have heard about domain-driven design and heard about it in the meaning of being just entities and repositories, for example. But as you saw here, entities and repositories aren't mentioned at all. This is the core of domain-driven design. Entities and repositories aren't unimportant, but not so important. We'll come back to them and touch them a little later today. So, I said I would talk a little bit more about the model word. And here is how I see how model code and a few other things fit together. First of all, we start out with the problem and the chosen solution, and we think about the problem and the chosen solution with a mental model, which is kind of abstract. The mental model is not trying to understand everything or capture the reality. It's not about that. It's about choosing what we need for understanding the problem and what we need for taking on that situation. So someone said that all models are wrong, but some are useful. I think that's quite good in that to understand what it's all about. Then when we have that mental model, we need to share that between between the members of the team, of course. We need to be able to work with it. So we represent that model in different ways, and I have four of my favorite representations here. First off, quite often I represent the model with UML as a sketch. So on a whiteboard with the team, we sketch how we see a little part of that total model with something like UML. But typically, I'm not doing that with some fancy tool or something like that. This is very low tech, whiteboard with a pen. That won't disturb our creativity. It won't hinder us. Second thing, I just mentioned the ubiquitous language, and I think that's a very powerful representation of the model. And as you see, I have a bidirectional arrow here between model and ubiquitous language. And what I mean there is that the ubiquitous language affects how we think about them, how the mental model looks. And when the mental model changes, that affects our ubiquitous language. But when the mental model changes, maybe it's not affecting our UML as a sketch, because those are transient. They go away. The next day, we might be in another room, for example. We might have photos of those whiteboards, of course. Third, code is another great representation of the model. It goes hand in hand with the ubiquitous language as much as possible. And at last, the user interface is just another representation. I think this has been taken care of a bit sloppy. We have not been using this as much as we should. As it turns out, drawing user interface prototypes, for example, that's a very, very, very powerful way of getting the collaboration going with the domain expert. Of course, different domain experts are different, so we need to have different tools for trying them out and see which works best. So, I have a little conversation here I'd like to try out. And I need some help for a conversation, since I'm not schizophrenic. So I asked my colleague, Per Ruvegård from Factor 10, is going to give another presentation tomorrow about domain-driven design. I'm a bit fluffy here today. Per is going to tell you about a real-world project and talk about more of the technical parts, so to say.
Hi, can you hear me? Yeah, great, thanks.
So in this little conversation, we are acting, Per is the domain expert and I'm acting as the developer. And the situation is that we are working in a company selling stuff on the net, something like Amazon. And this is very early on in our collaboration.
So Jimmy, we have one and only one definition of client. It is used everywhere and for the entire enterprise. And the definition is a company that that has bought from us in the past.
Wow. That's amazingly powerful, I think, to have just one single definition. Actually, that fits very well with my ambition of having a common library where we can reuse stuff, and client will be reused everywhere. Actually, I have that's my personal goal, to reuse as much as possible. That's the nirvana, I think.
Good for you. And clients that companies that buy for more than $1 million a year, we call small to medium-sized clients.
Okay, I've captured that, and I will use that everywhere.
Well, actually, we say enterprise sometimes too, and company must be okay too, because both mean the same as client.
Oh, okay. Okay, the act ends there, and Per was probably not too happy about our first little try of collaboration here. Yeah, he thought I was a bit strange, so much focus on words. And I got a bit irritated. They didn't really know their business. They had lots of different words everywhere. And maybe a bit strange start here. So lots of things went wrong here. Did you notice some proposal? First of all, I just said it before, if we think we can have one single definition in the whole company for client, we are probably having a problem coming up quite soon. That's not going to work out, because client means different things to different areas. Still, I think several of you have tried that in the past. I have, and it failed miserably. So I'm not doing that any longer. And also, the second problem, I think, was that reuse, that's nice when it happens. That's not at all my goal in life, definitely not. That's not going to work out. And for the same reason that the language didn't work out. So the class client is not better than the word client or definition going everywhere. We are going to have something like the lowest common denominator, and it's going to be bad everywhere, probably. Third problem, as I remember it now, was that I said to Pat that I just captured what he said. That's not how we develop the ubiquitous language. Because the domain experts, they might know a lot about the problem. They don't have a crisp language at all. So we need to challenge each other and try to develop the language. We try to guard that carefully together. So, yeah, I guess that was the most important parts. So let's talk about ubiquitous language a little bit more. And I have a proposal here, a little tool for getting started working with the ubiquitous language, a tool called Behavior-Driven Development, or BDD. Have you been using that, anyone? Okay, a few. So the idea is the following. We are using the old XP style of describing user stories, and it goes like this. As someone, I need to know who this is important to, as an insurance broker in this case. And the insurance broker has something he wanna or she want to accomplish. The insurance broker want to know who the goal customers are. And for a certain reason, there is a goal with this story. A story without a goal, we should just skip. That's not important to deal with. But in this case, the goal was to sell more. So this is something that has been used a lot by a lot of people. But I think it was Dan North who said that a story is just a promise of a discussion, because this is actually not helping too much. It's giving us a little abstract idea of that requirement. But we need something more, and I think a very powerful tool that we are using in several different situations is to have examples. And we are trying to come up with examples for this story, and we call them scenarios. And here is the first happy case scenario for this user story. And then I'm using the given when then syntax. Given customer Sven Svensson exists, when he buys insurance XYZ for $10,000, then he becomes a gold customer. So I'm setting up a situation here with given, then something happens, and then I'm checking my outcome. A very, again, low-tech syntax. And this little syntax here works most often very well together with domain experts. We have no barrier here at all. So in reality, if you try this out, I've been surprised over and over again how powerful this is in reality, not in a naive example like this. But typically, I'm able to write given customer on a whiteboard together with the domain expert, and then the discussion goes. And he and she says something, and someone else says, no, we are not doing it like that. Yeah, that happens every time. You just have to try it out. We will come back to this and see how we can take this further with using this for acceptance testing as well. A few more words, by the way. Maybe you noticed that I had very concrete words here in the scenario or in the example, like Sven Svensson or a certain amount. Maybe you've noticed in the past that when you are showing some user interface prototype, for example, for the clients, they would tell you that, well, in the prototype you said that we are selling to Volvo. We have never done that. And we as developers are, oh my God, that's not important, stupid. And so instead of fighting that, we should use it, of course. We should just go for it and be very concrete in the examples and the prototype and use what the domain expert knows. You are allowed to cheat as much as possible just to get the discussion going and the feedback loops flowing here. So just follow it instead of fighting it. So one more conversation together with Per. This time it's about learning and collaborating. We're still working in the same company, but now we are much later in the development of this product that we are coming up with. Something happened with Mike?
The mic is on now?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So I just realized something today. The concept activity is core to us and our business. It has to be incorporated into the system.
Oh, that's horribly late. I can't possibly do a big design change now. Maybe I can do some hacks in the UI to cover up for that.
Yeah, whatever. That new feature we talked about yesterday for the other subsystem, it has to be done by Friday or heads will roll.
Oh, why didn't you say that before? That's totally impossible, actually. We will do our best.
Good.
So, thank you, Pat. What happened now? Anything wrong here? Of course not. That's horrible. Have you seen that before, that we as developers, we are just doing as we are told? I hate that, actually. A friend of mine went to a pizzeria a couple of years ago, and he told the pizza baker, is that the word, that he wanted extra cheese on his pizza. And the baker guy said, no. I want extra cheese. No, he said. And he got quite irritated, actually. He wanted extra cheese. But the baker said, no, I'm not giving that to you. It's not going to be good. It's not going to taste well. And, I like that. We should challenge a little bit. Maybe not be rude or anything like that. But most often, the other guy will just be happy with that discussion. Maybe we could come up with something else. Maybe we shouldn't do that at all. It was just an idea of Per in that situation or something like that. That was definitely one problem here. Not just do as we are told. And the other thing was that Per had actually come up with what I call a breakthrough. And that's extremely important regarding domain-driven design. We shouldn't just skip that. It might happen at any time in the project. Quite often it happens for version 2 or version 3. And we can't force it to happen, but when it happens, it's very important to us. Actually, that word activity was grabbed from an old project of mine 10 years ago. In that case, it came from the developer saying, I don't remember if it was late or in the middle of the project, that maybe we should change quite a lot of stuff over here and use an activity concept instead. And that kind of turned everything around and it became so much better. Not without pain and sweat, but definitely it was worth it. So those breakthroughs, that's what we are hunting for. A typical sign of a breakthrough is that you get that irritated feeling that, why on earth didn't I come up with that earlier? It's so obvious. When you have that feeling, you know what happened. It wasn't your fault. You couldn't have created it. It will happen because you are working hard together with other people on this problem. Personally, I have a background in database-driven development. And if I compare database-driven development and domain-driven development, I think they are very different. For example, regarding this perspective. In the past, when I worked in a more database-centric style, quite often, very early on in the projects, I or someone else said, a bit frustrated, we have to set the database schema now so we can start work. Have you heard that? Maybe not. It happened to me several times. Domain-driven design is the opposite. It's more like saying, actually, we don't know a lot about this right now. Let's go for what we know about, and when we learn more, we change. That database schema in the database-centric style never changed. Most often not, at least. Unfortunately, it's probably the worst time ever in that project, the few first days, to set a design, because we will never again know as little about the problem as we did then. So it's just not good. We should, of course, use what we learn through the whole project. So even though we might not be able to take care of that breakthrough that very day, we should at least think about it and examine it and save it for the next week or something like that. Definitely. Oh, I forgot to show you that Per is irritated and I am irritated. No winner in there, and we want to have win-win all the time, of course. So, I started talking a little bit about that domain-driven design and database-driven design are a bit different. And to me, at least, that's a good way of describing this, because quite a lot of people are coming from a database-driven background and look at domain-driven design and they see what they've seen the last 10 or 20 years. It's kind of the same. Actually, I think it's not. I think there are very big differences. I try to point out a few of those. First of all, we're moving to another domain now. This is about video rentals. Maybe that's not even existing any longer, but anyway. So I have a little relationship here between customer and rental, and the question in a database-driven context about navigation is a non-question, because we're always able to navigate in both directions in a relational database. But in an object model, that is a very important question. How should we navigate the object model? How many of you think that we should navigate from customer to rental? Hand up. Yeah, I guess 30%. How many would navigate from rental to customer? 30, and 40% think that we should decide later, I guess. Or maybe you think, why not have it bidirectional? We can have navigation in both directions. We just need two different links. That's totally fine. To me, design is about taking decisions and cutting down on flexibility. We should not strive for optimal or full flexibility, in my opinion. It's better to cut down and make it as easy as possible for solving the problem. So I would not go for the bidirectional relationship in this case. Actually, what's the problem with the question here? Do you know? Why is it impossible to answer that question? Well, you can answer it, but it's hard to be right. We don't know about the context. So, yeah, we need more information here. Maybe the context is a customer-centric business intelligence-ish application. Maybe then it makes perfect sense to have the navigation from customer to rental. But if it's more like a shopping cart application, I would most probably have the relationship in the other direction. So we need to know more. Thank you. If we then decide on having a relationship from rental to customer, and we have a customer in front of us, and he will tell us, could you please show me all my rentals? I don't remember what I rented last week. Oh, we don't have a navigation in that direction. We can't tell the customer that. He would probably be a bit surprised. So what then? Then we add our old friend, the repository, for helping us out in that situation. So we add a friend there. So we decide on what should be loaded in memory as navigational relationships, but we always have a fallback going in the other direction by making a query, for example, to a database or something like that. Another database-centric example then. This is from a trigger on a rental table. And here, let's just say I'm protecting my database from not having rentals that I don't want to have because of age is too low of the customer compared to what he's trying to rent. And there is quite a lot of tech stuff here and several traps, actually. I've been spending way too much time writing TSQL in the past, and I still have a problem reading this and writing it even. And another approach, instead of just trying to store the rental, might be like this, more object-centric approach. In this case, I'm having a rental class with a method saying can checkout. And if I can't do a checkout, I will get a bool back saying that no, you can't do that for some certain reason. For example, because the status was wrong, or because of some of the chosen films of that rental has a higher age than the customer's age. So now, instead of trying to do it, I'm adding a little protocol here, making it very possible for the consumer to check the situation before that button is clicked, for example. To me, this is a much more polite way of programming, instead of getting a slap on the face. On the other hand, if I'm not following the polite way of interacting with the rental object, I'm actually being slapped when I break the protocol. So I'm reusing the can checkout method. In the past, I had the idea that, well, this is nice, but this is not performant enough. That totally changed my mind. This is extremely performant in most situations because we're not touching the database at all here. We did that before we started out. And so that just goes away most often. We don't have to have the logic together with the database for performance reasons. Actually, it might be negative for performance reasons. But what is extremely much more positive here is that this is so much more testable than the other solution. And testability is so important to me nowadays. If that's the... most often that's the only question I ask to decide if a design is good or bad. Is it testable? Yes or no? Let's skip this. So, one more try for describing the difference between database-driven development and object-centric development is by picking one of the tactical patterns. I started out describing domain-driven design with the core parts, the bigger parts, but still we have those tactical patterns that are a handy toolbox for us in many situations. I mentioned the repository a few minutes ago. Now I'd like to talk a little bit more about the value object that I think is so underutilized. Martin Fowler said something like, the only problem with object orientation is, you know, that nobody uses it. That's quite ironic. We are using C# every day or something like that. But we're not really going into the object-oriented style as much as we should. And one of those parts of object orientation, I think, is using the value object. So here's a little sketch that could be a database diagram or an object model. If this was a database diagram for a relational database, probably the DBA would get quite upset with us. We are having a one-to-one relationship between a rental table and a price table. The price table has a single field, sorry, column in that domain, and the price table has a relationship one-to-one to a discount table. Again, one more column. And the price table is also being one-to-one connected to the rental line, the film title. This is not a nice relational database design. On the other hand, this is a very nice object design, because here we are having this price concept that we found in the ubiquitous language, and we are capturing that in a class of its own with its own logic. It's testable in its own, and it's being reused or called from used in many different situations. But for testing in the price, we don't have to set up the full situation, not at all. So if we think about the domain model overall as the core of our application, as the most important part of our application, the value objects, they are the core of our domain model. So they are very much about capturing stuff at the very center and not repeating those things again. I have another example of value objects, a little bit more behavior focused than the price and discount example. Again, we are shifting domain. Now it's from the egg domain. And we are doing a simple calculation here. We are saying that Stina's eggs are 7 times 12 and Pelle's eggs are 3 times 20. And then we are just adding all those eggs and checking that we are having 144 eggs in the basket. So, quite easy. We don't have to struggle a lot with understanding that piece of code. But we could do better. There are important concepts here from the egg domain that we are not really taking care of. We could treat them in a more explicit way. Do you see them? Any proposal for a hidden concept here? Sorry? The egg container, I think that's a really good proposal. Unfortunately, not the one I was thinking about. Thank you. Anyone else? Sorry? Basket, I think that was the same, yeah. I think that's, again, I agree, that's a concept that is worth taking care of. The concept I was thinking about here is, at least in the Swedish egg domain, 12 is an important egg concept, and so is 20. It has a certain meaning in regarding eggs. So let's try if we can write this a little bit differently, and I try it again here. Now I have a value object called amount, and I have a static method for creating a value object, saying dozen, 7 dozen, or 3 scores of eggs. A little bit clearer, I guess. And what we are getting from the amount, sorry, from the dozen and the score, what is that? You know? You just have to guess. We are getting we're getting amount objects. And then we are adding those amount objects. And finally, we are deciding on in what way we are looking into that final amount object. So if we wanted to look on the final amount object, say gross instead, if there was a little transformation there, it was hidden in that class once and for all. It won't be repeated ever again in the application. A problem with domain-driven design is, as I said from the start, that it's about tackling complexity. We didn't have a lot of complexity here. On the other hand, I need tiny, simple examples. So here, maybe this didn't help a lot. In reality, this helps so much. I'm finding myself using value objects more and more for every day, and I'm just getting more efficient out of it. So we shift perspective and move over to architectural styles for implementing domain-driven design. There are many different styles for doing this. I think you should have a look at CQRS and event sourcing if you haven't already. I'm not going to talk about those, but read up on them on the network. Instead, I'm taking a classical style of implementing domain-driven design with a layering principle, and I think this is quite common to many applications out there. So we have a user interface talking over the network with a facade layer, talking to entities layer, talking to a data access layer, talking to the database on another box, something like that. I used this a lot in the past. I was very fond of it, and I actually added many more layers because it seemed to, the more the merrier. So the user interface actually had three layers, and the facade had two, and entities maybe one, data access two. The database, of course, they didn't touch the tables directly, had public sprocs and private sprocs and views. So something like 12 layers most often. So when I went out to a new client and we started talking about the problem we were about to solve, I told the client to wait a little bit while I was adding my template with all those layers, and then we started work. So that was what I was doing over and over again. I've totally noticed over the years a couple of problems with this approach, though. For example, I started working from the database upwards, and I spent a lot of time creating those tables in a perfect way as I saw it, and the sprocs too manually wrote all the code, and the data access, of course, I wrote that manually too. And when I was coming to the entities, I was running out of time, so I didn't spend a lot of time there at all. So I just had placeholders. Someday I will add stuff here, I said, something like that. So lots and lots of time spent on tech stuff. One of the reasons for doing this was that I wanted to protect the database from the outside. So I didn't want to reveal the database structure, for example. Unfortunately, I was sending record sets that more or less directly from the database over to the client. I didn't have to do it like that, but most often that was the case. So protection, 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 but here is the structure. And so it was totally visible all the way to the user interface. And the same with the rules, checking that I didn't break any business rules. I didn't have too much of that in reality. So the entities, or whatever you call it, business logic, was not getting a lot of attention. That's quite unfortunate, because that's about the business. That's about the problem. I find this to be not optimal any longer. Actually, I'm doing it the opposite now. I'm starting out like this. I'm putting all my energy where I didn't put a lot of energy at all before, on the domain model or the entities or the business logic. So the domain model is my very focus at first. Probably I add some user interface, maybe in a declarative way, to visualize my domain model for the business expert. Because when I start out working with the client, my main focus is to learn as much as possible, as quick as possible, about the business problem. I don't think about storage, for example. I know I'm quite skilled at that. I will solve that later on. If I started out with storage now, I know that I will go slower. I will have a tendency of listening to the client and skipping stuff. Oh, that will mean I have to, I don't do that now. So working in this way, I'm very quick in changing directions. By the way, forgot one thing. I recently heard one guy say that good architecture is like lasagna. The more layers, the better. And I think that's just wrong. I don't think lasagna tastes better because of many layers. Do you think that? That's wrong, wrong, wrong. And that goes for architecture as well. Actually, when he said that, I was longing for spaghetti instead for lasagna. Okay, so back to this. I'm quite sure many people in here now are thinking, well, this is just not allowed. You're not allowed to hook the user interface on top of a domain model. Is that true? Someone hating me for saying this? Well, for one thing, this is the starting point. Maybe this works the whole way I can do it like this. If it's not working out for me because of some reason, what on earth will I do then? You know? Add a layer, for example. We don't have to do that up front. We can do it whenever we see the need for it. We can change. It's called software for a reason. It's not hardware. It's soft. We are able to change it, or we should be able to change it at least. So when we are relaxing the focus on many layers with lots of ceremony, we are actually getting a possibility of focusing on something much more important, and that is the bounded contexts. So we are focusing on those more business-centric areas of the software instead of the much more technically focused layering I was just showing you. And that's a really, really good thing. And if one bounded context has 7 layers and another has 10 and the third has 2, that doesn't matter at all, because the inside of a bounded context, I'm not allowed to see that. It doesn't matter to me at the outside how it looks over there. I'm only allowed to interact with that bounded context on certain small points, small services or something like that. And that actually goes even for the database. If I have a database in a bounded context, I always treat that as an application database and not as an integration database. So nobody outside of my bounded context is allowed to touch my database. By having that separation between bounded contexts, I'm very able to make quick changes in over here without breaking something over there. And this is crucial for having a maintainable situation, in my opinion. Because sharing a database, then we have to synchronize all the changes in the future. Synchronization is tedious and horribly expensive and boring and everything, so we stop making changes. The other thing is that working in this way, I think this points us in the direction of not just having 100% focus on loose coupling. When services took off a couple of years ago, we had this amazing focus on 100% loose coupling. And I think that didn't work out. I think that was wrong. I didn't understand it back then, and I still believe it's wrong. We have to balance that with high cohesion, of course. An old rule, still correct. So that was a couple of different aspects or viewpoints on domain-driven design. So maybe you are thinking that this might be something to check out. I forgot to tell you about the book. How many of you have read the book by Eric Evans? Some of you have. The good thing is here is that those who haven't read it, you are so happy, because when you start reading that, you will become so happy. It's an enormously nice book. It reads like poetry, and you just go out and get it and read it. That will mean a lot to you, I'm sure. So, I'd like to show you a little example of how you can work with domain-driven design. And this is not at all prescriptive guidance. Definitely not. I'm totally against that. It doesn't work out. This is just an example of how you can do it. This is how I quite often work with domain-driven design. So, yet another domain here. This is from the time reporting domain. I guess it's a very common domain for example applications. So, we started out getting a couple of requirements. Maybe someone is thinking this is not a core domain for Christ's sake. Actually, it might be. Some companies, this is very much the core domain. Consultant companies, for example. So, one of the requirements say, customers and products can be registered. Customers have products and products can have people and activities. It sounds like a very data-centric requirement. But actually, domain experts has a tendency of expressing them in that direction or in that way. And I think it's because of us. It's our fault. We've been teaching a whole world of domain experts how we want to see the requirements. They come with database schemas to us. I'm the first to blame for that, I think. And a couple of more rules and stories in a mix here. We should obviously publish stuff on Facebook, for example. I think the most important story here is consultants can register time for a day on different products and activities. So we are going to start with that one. What we are going to do then is using this little process or flow. We are starting out with a little strategic design, getting a feeling for the whole picture. Where is this subsystem going to live? We are grabbing the most important and interesting story and creating a scenario for that. Probably shifting viewpoint and doing some UI sketching, using some UML as a sketch so the developers have the same mental picture in the head before starting coding. Transforming the scenario into an acceptance test, and that acceptance test will be the recipe for how to move forward with test-driven development, because there we will see what units we are needing. And we test drive those units, and then we just start out from the beginning again, grabbing the next story. So let's see how this could work out. First of all, some strategic design. This is not about big design up front. This is just about a little sketch for thinking about the situation here. So I put the time registration bounded context that I started to develop here in the middle, and it has dependencies to Facebook, for example. And that relationship is of a kind that we can't affect Facebook a lot. We just have to take what we get from there regarding the interface. On the other hand, the invoicing system is a totally different relationship because that has been developed in-house. So we can change that and tweak that if we need to. So we think a little bit about the situation here in a couple of minutes. Then we move to the next step, which is to create a story and a scenario. And I've done that in Visual Studio. Let's move there. Maybe, is it big enough? Change that a little bit. So, as you see, first of all, I have my story I formulate like this. As a consultant, I want to register time on my products so that customers are being invoiced correctly. And again, I'm using the given when then. And this was actually my solution for being a little bit trendy here today and talk about clouds. So I have a project here. I expect to have a project called Cloudy Sky, and it should be in a certain situation. So this is my starting point. This is the situation when something happens. I also have a consultant, and today has 0 hours for that consultant. Something happens. Bruce Wayne is registering 2 hours of programming on project Cloudy Sky. And then I have a new outcome that today has 2 hours. Again, when we are doing this in reality, we are starting out developing the language immediately together with the domain expert. But let's leave it like that for now. I did a little UI sketching to get a little feeling for how it could look for the user. And for everything I'm doing here now, I'm actually learning that I have misunderstood things before. So each step now is a feedback for the previous steps. So I'm learning. That's the reason I can't have a step here that is set in stone, because it was wrong. I'm feeling quite stupid when I start doing my UML as a sketch because now something else is obvious to me. But feeling stupid is a good thing because that means that you're learning. If you go around never feeling stupid, think about that a little bit. That's dangerous. So, my UML as a sketch here says that the day class is an aggregate route and it protects all my registrations for a certain consultant on a certain date. So I don't want anyone to interfere with my registrations. They have to talk to the day object for being able to do that. Actually, it's a little bit early to start thinking about aggregates here because I have a tendency of always making them wrong when I start out too early. So they have to change, but maybe this was decent. Again, I'm not thinking too much about details here. It's very, I'm almost sloppy, just getting the big picture up. Then over to Visual Studio again, because the next step is to transforming that scenario into an acceptance test. So I'm using a tool here called SpecFlow, which is one of the BDD tools out there, and there are quite many of them. And what is happening then when I'm doing that is that I'm actually using this piece of text here, this given line. I'm creating a step definition for that, sorry. And it could look like this. So here I have a regular expression for catching that text you just saw, that given text. And this part here means that I'd like it to be a parameter to my method. So the cloudy sky will be sent as a text or a string parameter to my method here. And then I'm actually using what I call wishful programming. So I'm thinking about how would I like the API to be on my model here. So maybe I should instantiate my project by injecting a customer and injecting a project name. That feels nice. And then I'm just having a sanity check that the project is okay and then, is ready for registrations. And then I have another object, which is a repository for saving that project, for making my step definitions a bit more isolated from each other and not needing lots of member variables here. Maybe some of you are surprised to see the naming of the repository because 99% of all the repositories out in the wild, they are actually having a suffix called repository. So I'm breaking a rule here, I guess. But the repository word, I don't think that adds anything at all to me. So I'm trying to play with the words here to go as close to the ubiquitous language as possible. Of course, C# has some problems that I have to live with, but as close as possible. So after my wishful programming session, I actually commented out those lines of code because they didn't compile. I didn't have any real code yet at all. This was my starting point. So I didn't have a project class or a customer class and so on and so forth. But what is really good here now is that this helps me out with something I know a lot of people are struggling with. How many of you are doing test-driven development all the time, writing tests first? Some of you are. Some of you might raise the hand might have tried and found it to be a bit hard. And a very common question is how to get started. Actually, we're looking at the recipe here for how to get started. Because here I'm saying, actually, I need a project class. Okay, and I should write that test first. That means I need a test first, fixture for that. So let's go there. And actually, I'm doing this in a very basic way here now, actually testing my instantiation. some of you might think that's a little bit too much, but well, when you start, why not go in this direction? Actually, I'm doing this in reality too. This will help me out sooner or later. So in the setup method, I'm setting up a situation, and then I'm having one test for each little tiny detail I'd like to check out that I'm doing right. And after a while, I'm coming down to more interesting parts here. So after each test, of course, I write that real code to make that test become green. So I move forward stepwise here in a very controlled way. And finally, I'm expecting the product that was just created to be ready to get registrations. And again, you are finding those words from the early scenario descriptions you saw here. So I'm trying to stay close to the language once again. So we are getting a very nice flow here. We know what to do next from those test cases, those acceptance tests that I wrote. What will happen is that for the first acceptance test you write, it will take some time because you have to write quite a lot of small unit tests and classes. But for the next scenario, it will go faster because you have done quite a lot of basic work, so to say. So I've been touching on it a little bit, but I just want to show you again that in my repository class, my projects, of course, I test drive this as well. So it's not just happening. I'm creating unit tests for it. But as I said, when I start out with a new project, I don't think about the database. And here is the proof. I'm actually just faking a database or something behind those repositories. I don't care about storage now. I don't want to be distracted by all that pain of those problems that I will have with the storage. So this is fine for me right now. I can go quite fast and quite far in this approach. So something else I wanted to point out, a very common thing. Once again, I'd like to point out that I'm not focusing on the technical aspects. Quite often you would find, let's go for that one. So, quite often you would find a project for the repositories and the project for the factories and the project for the value object and so on. I'm not organizing my code at all like that. I'm organizing my code in the aggregates instead. So my project aggregate is having all those classes that are interesting for that part. So it's much more of a domain-focused organization. This is a tiny little thing, but something I've rarely seen out there, and I'm using it a lot, and it helps me a lot, so I just wanted to touch on it. And a final question regarding the flow here. Sorry, a final comment regarding the flow. Oh, I can't type and talk at the same time. That's a self-test. I am a male, yeah. Okay, so important part here is that when we start out trying to understand as much as possible about this domain, we're not focusing on the nitty-gritty details. We're not focusing on border cases and things like that. We go for the happy case first and move from that happy case over to another one. When we understand the big picture, then we go into the details and add more situations, exceptional situations, for example. So we have 40 seconds left, so it's time for the summary. We have covered a lot of ground here today regarding domain-driven design, and I said that I think it's very important to challenge. If we do that and combine that with the T model, focusing both on the business part and the technical part, and combining that with domain-driven design, I think we are able to take huge leaps and have an exponential effect. Tomorrow, Per and Julie will talk about other aspects of domain-driven design. Per will talk about a real-world application, and Julie will talk about entity framework and domain-driven design. So please go and see those two. I'm done now. I will be around, so please come over if you'd like to talk to me. Thank you very much.